You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we want to hear your stories of the best things you've ever gotten for free, whether it's a Craigslist find or something left on the curb. We talk about the surplus of free stuff ahead. Now, while the U.S. House of Representatives today is taking up President Biden's COVID relief bill, yesterday the body passed a piece of legislation referred to as the Equality Act. It's an amendment to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and the bill gives explicit protections to people based on gender identity and sexual orientation. Supporters of the bill say it would shore up what's currently more of a patchwork of LGBTQ protections in just some states, while other states don't have their own anti-discrimination laws. Meanwhile, some opposition to the bill centers around concepts of religious freedom and protections for women. Our guest for this conversation is Christy Mallory from the UCLA School of Law. She focuses on state and local laws and policies that affect members of the LGBTQ community. She also happens to be a native of Mequon. Christy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Keely.
You're legal director at the Williams Institute. Tell us about the mission of that institute.
Yeah, the Williams Institute is a research center based at UCLA, dedicated to conducting rigorous and credible research on sexual orientation and gender identity law and public policy. And it's our goal to disseminate this research to policymakers and judges, the media, the public, and other stakeholders to really ensure that legal decisions and policy decisions that impact LGBTQ people are based on data and facts.
We're talking about what's been called the Equality Act, and this might sound familiar to some people. How long has this legislation been in the works?
Oh, gosh. You know, some iterations of this bill have been around going back decades, back to the 70s when lawmakers first wanted to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation in employment. It has repeatedly come up in Congress and after Congress after Congress, and over the years has been expanded, you know, in this way you just described, to now prohibit discrimination not only based on sexual orientation, but also based on gender identity. So that is discrimination against transgender people. And the bill has also been expanded over the years to reach a variety of different areas of life. So it's no longer confined to employment non-discrimination, but now we're seeing these protections for education and credit, jury service, public accommodations, housing, really the full slate of civil rights laws across the country.
We're talking with Christy Mallory with UCLA's School of Law. She's our guest talking about equality and legal protections. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the legal and policy implications of the legislation that is in Congress right now? Is this something better left up to individual states and local governments to manage, or do you think that we need national legislation? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Christy, the House passed a similar bill in 2019, but it didn't go anywhere. What happened?
Yeah, it didn't go anywhere. It didn't even get brought up in the Senate. But of course, we've seen some huge changes in Congress this year. So I think it's an exciting time. Obviously, all eyes are on the Senate right now. I think we expected the House to pass it. But what will happen in the Senate is anyone's guess.
And in the House, we saw three Republicans vote with all of the Democrats on this measure. Is that does that bipartisanship tell us anything, or are we really dealing with two completely different entities here when it comes to how the House and the Senate might swing?
Yeah, so that's a great question. You know, so you mentioned a patchwork of state laws that protect people from discrimination based on these characteristics already. So we kind of have an understanding of the political landscape around these laws based on the experiences of these states. In recent years, as more states and localities have begun to pass these protections, we see the support become more bipartisan. I think it used to be thought of as really a Democrats' issue, but that's no longer the case anymore. state by state, locality by locality, we are seeing more Republicans really get on board to support equality.
Do you see much variation among state laws, or are they fairly similar in what they're trying to do?
Yeah. So the states that have these legal protections from discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity, those laws look pretty consistent across the states. What is inconsistent is, you know, we have this big divide. We have states that include those characteristics in their non-discrimination laws, and then we have the states that don't. So I teach a class at the UCLA School of Law, and each year I ask my students which state they think was the first to pass a sexual orientation non-discrimination law. And every year, without fail, they guess the same few. I hear California, Massachusetts, Oregon, but it was actually none of those. The first state to pass a law prohibiting sexual orientation discrimination was, and maybe some of the listeners already know this, but it was Wisconsin back in 1982. So Wisconsin really led the way there. But since then, we've seen 22 more states follow. And so now about half the U.S. adult population is already covered by these non-discrimination protections at the state level. The other half, of course, are living in states without these statewide protections, but many live in localities with the protections. So that's kind of what people are talking about when they refer to this patchwork of protections that exist at the state and local level.
The laws are one thing, the way that they're written and what they do, but it's another thing to apply them. So from a policy standpoint, what more can you tell us about how these anti-discrimination laws at the state and local level are implemented?
Yeah. So, you know, non-discrimination laws serve two main functions, really. They both act as a deterrent to discrimination. And this is sort of why the Equality Act would also help employers, businesses, and other entities that would be covered under the act, because it helps them to know what the law is in a clear way. And we just don't have that situation for LGBTQ people right now in the U.S. So by bringing these clear nationwide protections, entities will know what's expected of them. People will also know that they have these protections, which is beneficial as well. But then the other main goal of non-discrimination laws, of course, is to remedy discrimination where it's already happened. So just like we know, race discrimination is not over in this country just because we have civil rights laws going back to the 60s prohibiting such discrimination against people of color in the U.S. So, of course, we will continue to see discrimination occur. We continue to see discrimination against LGBTQ people occur in the states that have these laws in place. But they really do make a difference. They're symbolically important. They make people feel better, feel less fear. They're not worried about hiding who they are at work to their coworkers when they're having a conversation around the water cooler. And they also, you know, they provide remedies to people. So if discrimination has happened, people are able to go to court and seek remedies for what they've experienced, monetary damages. You know, and that in itself can also serve as a deterrent to employers. Sometimes hearing about another employer involved in a high profile lawsuit where a plaintiff happened to recover a lot of money kind of sends a message to them that this is not OK.
What about the flip side of being in court? Are states having to defend those laws in court?
You know, for the most part, no. Again, these laws have gone back decades to Wisconsin's in 1982, and they've caused very little problems. So I think that's why we're in an interesting spot with the Equality Act, too, is this these kind of protections, this method of protecting people has been tested. We've seen that the sky does not fall when states pass laws that prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. They're implemented just like other laws that prohibit discrimination against people based on race and sex and religion. The administrative agencies that handle these laws know how to do it. The courts know how to do it. People know how to follow them. So this is really not new, what's in the Equality Act. Does it shore up some of these gaps? Yes. Does it make sure people have nationwide protections in all areas? Yes. Does it clarify the law? Of course. But it's really just building on all this progress we've already seen to get those protections just across the finish line.
We're talking with Christy Mallory from the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law, and we're looking at the legal and policy implications of the Equality Act, which the U.S. House passed yesterday. It's headed over to the Senate. You are part of this conversation. Call 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about what's happening right now when it comes to protected classes? Do you think that this is something better left up to individual states and local governments to manage? Or do you think that the federal government needs to push for a national standard right now? What would you like to see lawmakers discuss or change as this bill moves forward? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. There's a line for you there. Or you can email us your questions at ideas@WPR.org. We continue this conversation next on Central Time. We're talking about the Equality Act the House of Representatives passed yesterday and the legal and policy implications it could have if it moves forward through the Senate. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Our guest is Christy Mallory. She's the legal director at the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law. And here on the Ideas Network, we want to hear from you. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Ask us your question. We've got Will from Platteville on the line. Hi, Will.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My question was, how does the Equality Act change the precedent set in June 2020 with Gorsuch writing the majority on the joint discrimination cases for Title VII, Title IX that includes transgender and other LGBTQ identities under those laws?
Yeah, well, thanks so much for that question about the Supreme Court decision that came in June of last year. Christy.
Yeah, thanks, Will. That's a really great question. So as you've mentioned, the legal landscape in this area really changed pretty significantly through that decision issued by the Supreme Court in a case called Bostock versus Clayton County. So the case was brought by employees who had been discriminated against by their employers based on their sexual orientation and gender identity. So the case was brought under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which is our federal non-discrimination law that prohibits employment discrimination based on race, sex, national origin, and a bunch of other characteristics. And what was important there, though, is just like we're talking about the Equality Act, that law does not expressly include the terms sexual orientation and gender identity. But what these employees argued is that discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity violated Title VII's prohibition on sex discrimination. So the logic there in that argument was that sexual orientation and gender identity discriminations are so intertwined and inseparable from sex discrimination that they are really forms of sex discrimination that's illegal under that law. Essentially, that an employer could not possibly discriminate against an LGBTQ person without also discriminating against them based on their sex. And a majority of the court agreed with this in a pretty surprising 6-3 holding that I think many people were at first maybe, you know, I think it kind of struck a lot of people, especially in my field as well. That's a number I wasn't expecting to come out of the court here. But when you look at the history of this claim, these arguments, these type of cases, lower courts had been finding this for a long time, finding that sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination were forms of sex discrimination. So in a sense, it really wasn't new. It was just the Supreme Court affirming the decision of many, many lower courts who had already held this. So the question really was, how does the Equality Act interact with and affect this decision or vice versa? So that decision, of course, I said that the sex non-discrimination piece in Title VII was really the essential hook there. So many of the federal non-discrimination laws prohibit discrimination based on sex. And we look at the Bostock case and we think, well, yeah, all of those laws should be interpreted with the court's decision here. Other courts and even the Supreme Court often look to Title VII case law when figuring out how to interpret analogous provisions in other laws like the Fair Housing Act or Title IX or these things. So we think, yeah, this probably extends to all sex non-discrimination laws. But what the Equality Act does is, first of all, it clearly says, Yes, these are protected characteristics in all these other laws. So we don't have to now rely on other courts looking at what the Supreme Court did here and figuring out should it apply to this law too. You run the risk in that of courts in different areas coming to different conclusions. So the Equality Act cuts out all of that and just makes these protections applicable to all underlying civil rights laws. The other important thing that the Equality Act does is adds a sex non-discrimination protections to some civil rights laws where that characteristic is not already included. So people may not know that the federal public accommodations non-discrimination law doesn't already prohibit discrimination based on sex. And so public accommodations is sort of a legal term that refers to certain types of businesses and other establishments that serve the public. So as of right now, if a woman experienced public accommodations discrimination based on her sex, she has no recourse under federal law. So the equality makes that change too. So just going back to what it would look like if we only had Bostock and not the Equality Act, public accommodations is a huge area that's left out because you don't have that sex non-discrimination hook in the law to rely on the Bostock reasoning.
Thanks so much for the call, Will. We appreciate it. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234 as we talk with the legal director at the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law. Christy Mallory's work is centered around laws and policies that affect members of the LGBTQ community. And we've got Joan from Milwaukee. Hi, Joan.
Hi there.
What are you thinking about in this conversation?
I just had a question about the Equality Act and how it would help LGBTQ women of color specifically.
Just wondering, sure, if there's anything specific to people of color in that. Thanks so much for the question, June. Christy, what are we dealing with the Equality Act?
Yeah, that's a really great question, too. So, you know, what we see in the data, when we look at how LGBTQ people experience discrimination and experience the hardships that result from discrimination, like health impacts and economic instability, we see that oftentimes LGBTQ people of color and LGBTQ women are hardest hit. The disparities that we see between non-LGBTQ people and LGBTQ people are exacerbated for people who have other marginalized characteristics. You know, we also see when people actually experience, so I'm talking about data here and sort of aggregate level disparities, but when we see how people experience discrimination in the world, often cases are brought by LGBTQ women, LGBTQ women of color, other LGBTQ people of color, and they have experienced various compounded forms of discrimination, for example, by the same employer. What sometimes happens in those cases is the courts will look at the evidence that the plaintiffs have marshaled and they'll say, oh, well, you know, this actually looks mostly like sexual orientation discrimination and not really because of your race or sex. So you don't have a viable claim here. So that's, we've actually seen that happen in courts where they try to parse out what the discrimination looks like. It's really hard often to separate discrimination based on sex and based on sexual orientation and gender identity, which the Bostock decision really affirmed. So having these protections in place means that people with multiple marginalized identities will ensure that all of their identities are protected from discrimination.
There's an argument here with the Equality Act about the potential damage to women's athletics, the privacy of women's locker rooms and bathrooms, specifically when it comes to trans people who identify as female. How is this argument playing out?
Yeah. So, you know, some opponents of non-discrimination laws have made those claims that these laws may jeopardize privacy or safety in these facilities. But research and experience just shows that this is really not the case. So like I mentioned before, many states and localities already have these non-discrimination laws in place. And like we've talked about, have had them for decades. And we just don't see these types of problems arise. At the Williams Institute, we actually did a study a few years ago, which showed that non-discrimination laws were not associated with any increase in crimes in bathrooms or other shared facilities. And even beyond that, there are existing laws all over the place in the U.S. that protect people from crimes in bathrooms. And these are the laws that should and already do address the issues that opponents are pointing to. These things aren't happening because of the presence or absence of a non-discrimination law. They're happening and need to be dealt with the law in a different way.
Another aspect of this when it comes to opposition to this bill is that it would infringe on legally protected religious freedom. Help us understand what the legal basis for that argument is.
Yeah, so some people have also claimed that laws that prohibit discrimination based on people's sexual orientation and gender identity will burden religious beliefs or religious exercise. And again, I'm just going to stress that we have decades of experience with this, and we know how these laws work. We know that that is not happening. And, you know, I want to point out, too, that existing federal civil rights laws that the Equality Act modifies. Again, the Equality Act is not really a standalone bill, but comes in and amends and updates the Civil Rights Act. So these laws have carve-outs already for religious organizations, which give them a lot of freedom in who to hire, for example. And the Constitution also protects hiring decisions for religious institutions to a significant degree. Similarly, state laws have these carve-outs. So, you know, religious organizations will be pretty much free to operate as they always have under these existing laws. And again, because of the Bostock decision, this has already happened to some degree, right? The horse is already out of the barn a little bit here. So then, you know, there's this other claim that centers around maybe not a religious organization's practices, but religious people acting out in the world as employers or as owners of a business. So that the analysis there is a little bit different, because once an employer or retailer or whoever enters the public sphere to serve customers or to hire a bunch of employees, the rules change a bit. And in those cases, history and lawmakers have decided that non-discrimination laws are really important and serve the government's and society's interest in eradicating discrimination and ensuring equal treatment of all Americans. And that's really what's going on here, is when you enter that public space, you know, different rules apply.
Right. Christy, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Christy Mallory is legal director at the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law. Coming up, nothing in life is truly free except that gently used couch and scrap wood that someone's always giving away on Craigslist. Join in our conversation about free stuff at 800-642-1234. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Looking ahead to Monday, we ask, what do you do to start conversations? We consider ourselves stylists or engineers or salespeople. So it can be difficult when we define ourselves by our work and we lose the job. We're talking about work and our identity on Monday. Central Time is here from 3 until 6. Now, there's a lot to be said about the story of stuff. We are always buying, trying not to buy, or dealing with all of the stuff we already have. And one way people have been dealing with stuff lately is by trying to give it away. Facebook Marketplace, Craigslist, or the old standby, just put it out on the curb, see if anybody takes it. There's been an uptake in free stuff out there lately, and we want to hear from you about that at 800-642-1234. Tell us your stories about the free stuff you now call your own. That number again is 800-642-1234, or you can comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We already heard from a few listeners who left us comments on Facebook. Zaina found a quarter-sawn oak baptismal font. That's the basins that churches use for baptisms. The listener went on to say it was from the Catholic Church in Bangor, Wisconsin. They found it while poking around in a dump where they found the lid, and then later a worker there told them he had the rest of it by a shack. Zaina had to pay $1 for it. The lid was free. And Janet said she found an outdoor cast iron table set complete with a glass tabletop. So here to guide us on this inexpensive journey is James Haggerty. He's a staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He recently wrote the piece called Free Stuff is All Over Craigslist and Facebook, and it's getting weirder. James, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thank you.
Okay, chicken or egg question here. Were you assigned to write the story first, or did you notice that there was an unusual amount of free stuff around you?
Well, my wife was trying to give away some free stuff, some old snow boots from my daughter long ago. And I got kind of curious, what are people offering for free? And so I started looking on Craigslist and on Facebook, and I found all kinds of unexpected stuff, and I decided it would be worth writing about.
So what are some of the typical things you found when searching on Craigslist and Facebook?
Well, the really typical things are, believe it or not, piles of dirt, old bricks, scraps of wood, TV sets of the old bulky variety, mattresses, moving boxes. But then I found a lot of stuff that was really weird.
Okay, so you got to tell us about something there. What's weird that you're finding?
Well, for instance, somebody was giving away bathing dust for a chinchilla. Somebody put on two in Las Vegas, offered two buckets of what they called old gasoline with a picture of them in the buckets. Somebody was offering a barrel of used soybean oil. There were five packets of Arby's sauce. That one I later found out was a joke.
Okay.
There were a lot of books of Mormon being offered in Utah, including a Mongolian language version.
Interesting. So just things that, I don't know, I guess I wouldn't have thought to post to give away something like the soybean oil I already used. Do we know why people are posting this stuff or thinking, hey, maybe somebody wants this for free?
Well, that did make sense. And when I found out about it, I called up the guy who offered the soybean oil, and he told me he has a charity in Ohio. Every Thanksgiving, he cooks a lot of turkey dinners for the needy, and he cooks a lot of the turkeys in oil. And afterwards, he's got to do something with this soybean oil. And it turns out that soybean oil is very good for animal feed, as an ingredient for animal feed. And he put it up on Craigslist, and within 90 minutes, a farmer had claimed it.
Within 90 minutes.
Yeah. So that was a hot commodity. There was another fellow I talked to who was trying to give away a cracked bowling ball. That one took a while longer, but it finally found a taker, too.
Wow. James Haggerty has written about free stuff and the fact that it can get kind of weird. So what have you seen? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Do you browse the internet or the neighborhood for free things? What's the best thing you've ever found, gotten for free? Maybe you're on the other end of this. Have you had success getting rid of unwanted items when you put $0 attached? Still time for your call at 800-642-1234 as we talk with James Haggerty here. James, are we really seeing more free stuff listings, or does it just feel like it?
We are seeing it. I believe Facebook told me that their number of free offerings in their marketplace section nearly doubled last year. And I think it's because people were stuck at home, obviously, and had some time to try to clear out the clutter. And at the same time, it wasn't a great time to go to Goodwill or have a garage sale. And so people discovered here is a good way to offer stuff, keep it from being wasted. You can put it on Craigslist or Facebook. People can pick it up on your front lawn or on your porch, or sometimes people meet somewhere. And it's all pretty easy and safe.
I can admit to this. A couple of years ago, we drove around the block an extra time because I saw a side table on the curb and thought it had potential. So we put it in the back of the van and got it home. And then I left it outside for like a winter. And then there's that whole thing. And I still have not fixed it up. And it's sitting in my living room. But one of the things you've noticed is that people put things that are broken out there because somebody else might be able to fix them up and use them.
Oh, definitely. Once we put out a broken lawnmower, because we knew that somebody could fix it, and that had a lot of demand. There's a lot of really valuable stuff that is put out, good furniture. Many people furnish their whole home with free furniture. If you've got a truck and you want to drive around in an affluent neighborhood, it's pretty easy.
Yeah, we've got Robin in Baraboo on the line now. Welcome, Robin.
Hi. Oh, we're already laughing. What did you see?
I think admitting is the first step, right?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Needless to say, Facebook is dangerous and I'm not allowed on it without supervision. I currently have a used doctor's exam table that was given to me free. For what reason I have it?
But you see some sort of potential deep down when you look at that used doctor's exam table, Robin.
You never know. I do pedicures, manicures, and facials. It might come in handy someday.
I love the question mark on the end of that sentence, Robin. Go ahead, James.
No, I think I could see having that around. Or the baptismal font, I think that would be great to have. You never know when somebody's going to drop in and ask to be baptized.
Right. So just having it on hand, you know, is a good thing.
Or need his appendix out, maybe.
Right, right. Robin, thank you so much for admitting that to us here on Central Time. We've got Casey in Fenimore here for the conversation, too. Hey, Casey.
Well, hey there. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. What are you thinking about?
I was listening and all these conversations about free stuff. Well, I've been having problems giving away free stuff. The stuff that I try to give away, no one seems to want, like lawn chairs or a free couch or something. But if I slap on a dollar amount on it, like let's say $20 or $10 or $5, people seem to like buy it instantly, right away.
Oh, Casey, thanks for sharing that. James, do we have a little bit of a stigma when it comes to free stuff? Like maybe if somebody wants to give it away for free, it's not quite worth it.
Yeah, I have heard people say that. Occasionally it does work better if you put a small price on it.
Huh. Interesting.
It depends on who's looking that day, you know.
I guess, right. It's all about the audience, and you never quite know what that's going to be. The photos and the words that people use to describe items are also part of this story you looked into. What different methods do you see being employed here to convince people to take free stuff?
A lot of my fun were, you know, just very honest. You know, they don't want to try to put the hard sell on a broken piece of furniture. You know, one had a picture of a dresser drawer out in a snowbank in Lincoln, Nebraska, and it said it was adequate. You know, I thought that was a good description for it. And then the guy who was giving away the buckets of gasoline noted that it was old, you know, so you wouldn't think that he just put it in there yesterday. So I think people, they don't want to oversell their goods, but they want to find a good home for them if possible.
Do you think the story of our free stuff offers some sort of insight on how and what we're all doing in this really confusing year?
Yeah, I think, well, people do want to declutter, and I think people want to be generous. They don't want to waste things, and they don't want to fill up landfill with stuff, particularly dangerous stuff. And I think it's a good sign that people are being generous and that other people who need things are taking advantage of that. But both sides are happy.
Yeah.
Probably often the person giving away is happier than the person getting.
Right. I think that might be true for sure in some of these cases. James, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was James Haggerty, a staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He wrote a piece about the growing amount of weird free stuff. We've got a link to that writing at WPR.org/Central Time. And Ricardo and Madison wanted to let us know that Ricardo got a Sony TV for free on Craigslist, originally worth $2,500, and they've still got it to this day. Coming up, we'll talk with a former pro golfer about his efforts to diversify the game and give more black players the chance to compete at a high level. That's next here on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network, and this evening you can hear a national news roundup. Congressional Democrats are digging in on a higher federal minimum wage. Pfizer looks at what a third dose might do, and a new one-dose vaccine from Johnson & Johnson seems good to go against the coronavirus. We've got those conversations on and more on 1A+. It starts at 6 o'clock. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. An historic golf league is being revived with the goal of making the game more diverse. The United Golfers Association was founded in 1925 by African American players to host their own tournaments at a time when they were officially banned from the PGA Tour. The sport got rid of its whites-only rule in 1961, but even today, black golfers make up just a handful of professional players and instructors. The new version of the UGA started last year, and it hopes to change that by giving aspiring players the chance to practice at a high-tech training facility, to take parts in tournaments, and to learn about the business side of the game. Andy Walker is one of the 29 black golfers who's competed on the PGA Tour. He's director of player development for the United Golfers Association. Earlier this week, he talked with Central Time producer Dean Kinetter.
Your work with the United Golfers Association is about providing opportunities to compete. And you might think that here in 2021, in the wake of the Tiger Woods era, that there would be more African-American golfers than ever. But that's not the case. What has the number of black professional players looked like over time?
Well, you know, I think back 20 years ago, even more than 20 years ago now, actually about 40 years ago, there was quite a bit of number of African-American tour players out there. A lot it due in part because of the UGA's involvement in their development and their support system, not only monetarily, but they traveled together and practiced and played together. They had a venue of playing, and it was their development system to play on the big tour. And so since the Caucasian-only clause was rescinded from the PGA bylaws, the UGA was disbanded in essence. And so there just wasn't that development system. Then here we come, you know, 20 years later, and you have Tiger come, and Tiger's kind of an anomaly. So they didn't, you know, I think all the resources was put into showcasing Tiger, not to developing more Tigers. And so the PGA Tour and everybody did really good, you know, in kind of branding their the organizations around Tiger. But it really was really a lot slower, you know, coming to fruition. And the few that have played out there on tour, you know, Joseph Bramlett and Cameron Champ and Harold Varner and myself and Tim and some of the other guys, you know, we all had access and resources to play at the highest level. So we kind of made the best with what we had and use that. And so now what we're trying to do is really revive a whole crop of young players, from junior players to amateurs, men and women, all the way up to professional players, and really give them the best resources available at an early age so they don't kind of fall through those cracks.
And you mentioned that the UGA originally disbanded in, I think, 1976. And at that time, there were a fair amount of players of color on the tour. And a lot of them, as you said, got their start when the UGA was providing those opportunities.
Yeah, they did. And so, you know, they couldn't play on the big show, but what they did was they had their own big show. And so the players went out there and groomed their games and learned how to win and learned how to compete at the highest level and make a living while doing it. And so, you know, it was more of a transition into the PGA Tour when they had an opportunity to play there. They were already ready. So they had a developmental system. Nowadays, with the game being so, I guess, high tech, you know, the players need to be trained at a little higher level. You're not going to get so many of those, you know, quote unquote caddy swings being successful on tour, even though there still are going to be a few. But, you know, what we're trying to do now is really support them. Historically, there's been a lot of grassroots programs to help minorities and really disenfranchised and people of a lower socioeconomic background get into the game. But there's been nothing, once they show interest or a little bit of promise in the game, there's been nothing to take them from, you know, second base all the way home. And so, or from first base all the way home, to be honest. So, you know, so that's, like I said, that's where we're going to come in. But there was a lot of players out there. You had Calvin and you had the Thorpes, Bill and Chuck and Jim and you had, you know, Charlie and Lee and so many great players that were, you know, playing back there. I mean, I would, and the women as well, you know, Renee Powell was playing on that and won the national UGA National Open as well. So there were so many good players at that time, but there was in essence, there was an association, there was a fraternity through the UGA that linked them all together and there was resources available to them and there was a bond that they all shared. Once that was taken away, you know, we just kind of started falling by the wayside a little bit.
And you've been getting this new effort off the ground over the past year. Can you talk a bit more about kind of the goals you have for the new UGA and how it's going to hopefully remove some of those barriers to entry?
Well, what we're going to do is, you know, I tell everyone we're building Wakanda for golf. And so it will be the most state-of-the-art, sophisticated practice facility in the world. So it won't just be a decent place to come and get some work done. It's going to have everything you're going to need to be a better player, and more importantly, a better competitive player. Inside of that, we're going to build an environment to where we're going to support grassroots programs, whether it is monetarily, whether it is with resources and access, whether it's with facilities, clubs, training their trainers to make sure that the players are getting good training from an early age. But we're going to also provide a resource and a atmosphere that players are going to feel welcomed. You know, it's a game that can be pretty exclusionary, and it has a history of doing so. So, you know, we want to make sure that people feel welcome, they feel wanted in this game, because they're definitely needed. And the more players of color that come to this game, I think the better the game's going to be. So we will, while training them to be the best players possible, we're going to be exposing them to the agronomy side of the game. We're going to be exposing them to the business side and the club pro side of the game. We're going to be exposing them to the hotel and travel industry part of the game. You know, people can make a really good living inside of this game that don't have to play on tour. And that's what we want to, you know, make sure, is that we do produce more tour players, but we're producing more players that or more golfers that are going to have a great living. You know, inside the golf industry, you need advertising and marketing people. You need accountants. You need, you know, financial analysts. You need all the different types of people. And you can do that inside of this great game of ours.
We're talking with Andy Walker right now, Director of Player Development for the United Golfers Association, a group he's helping to revive to give more Black players the chance to compete in golf. And Andy, you recently wrote that in your time as one of the few Black players on the PGA Tour, there were moments where you felt unwelcome or treated with outright suspicion. Do you think that helping a few more Black players reach that pro level, or as you said, become coaches and mentors, will kind of create a culture where your everyday player doesn't have to worry about being treated like an outsider?
Definitely. I think the more you see players of color on tour, you know, the less it's going to become foreign to the outside people, or the people that may be working at these venues or that are even running the venues. And so, you know, if you don't just see Tiger, which is, you know, very recognizable, and you see some of the players of color out there, they're not super known like everyone else is. So, you know, that's what we want to do, is just foster an environment of inclusion, but really flood the market, right? I mean, I think the more you see, you know, I don't think it's far-fetched to say you can go into the finest clubs in this country, private clubs, and you're not going to see a lot of people that look like me working inside the pro shop, and especially not being GMs and director of golfs and head pros at those facilities. They're probably outside scrubbing wrenches or working in the kitchen. And so, you know, the more that we get people of color in prominent positions that, you know, that are qualified to be there, then it's going to be a, you know, it'll be a lot more accepted, but it won't be, you wouldn't feel like someone playing basketball wouldn't be included because there's so many of people of color playing basketball. So that's how we want the golf to look. And people have been saying it for a long time. We want golf to look more like America. It doesn't right now. So, you know, we want to definitely help change the complexion of the game.
And in your first year, what has the response been like? Do you feel there's momentum there in the game?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think us being on this call right now is momentum. And you know, the awareness of what's going on. And obviously, post-tragedy of George Floyd, there's been this social awakening. So there's a lot of momentum going on. There used to be just kind of mindless talks before. And I think now people are kind of joining and banding in with those talks, and the people that have been going through it for a while and realizing that there's a problem. And so, you know, things are moving forward. They're moving forward really fast right now. You know, currently I'm working with about 6 or 7 of our young Black professionals. This summer I'm going to start doing some camps with some of our young African-American men and women that are playing junior golf. We have some very talented players. And so we really just want to kind of up the ante, to say, and help their development, their growth in this game. So I'm really excited, you know, and our thing is to be kind of a hub for everybody in this game, to be honest, but really show a keen interest in developing and nurturing these African-American players, because they have just been so historically left by the wayside.
Well, Andy, good luck in the coming year, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And, you know, thanks for keeping up the good fight.
Andy Walker is a former professional golfer and director of player development for the United Golfers Association. That's a group he's bringing back to help more Black players compete and pursue careers in the game. He talked with Central Time producer Dean Kinetter. The weekend is closing in. Look ahead to Monday on Central Time. We're talking about the latest on a massive coronavirus relief measure working its way through Congress. Our guest analyzes whether it can become law and what stands in the way. Also, our identities are intertwined with the work that we do. That has consequences when we lose a job, and that's happened to hundreds of thousands of people in the last year. Join us for that conversation. And flu season has been incredibly quiet this winter, but scientists aren't sure the low levels of influenza will last. Learn about that Monday on Central Time. And weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. On Monday, a lawyer shares an end-of-life checklist to settle our affairs. We're talking about how to prepare a will, estate trusts, and different types of guardianship. Tune into the Ideas Network at 8 o'clock on Monday morning for that conversation. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we hear about the biggest player in Wisconsin's school choice program. It's open enrollment. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is Central Time.